speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy.
May the turbulence of our age yield to the true time of peace, when men and nations shall share a life that honors the dignity of each, the brotherhood of all.
I see a world of open borders, open trade, and most importantly, open mind.
Hello and welcome to this month's episode of To the Republic. I am Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
And Jeff is back.
I'm here.
Yeah, last month we ended up doing a rerun of our show because just time constraints had popped up and everything was that was going on. So what we ended up doing, I had to quarantine and then just threw off when we were able to record. So we appreciate you guys understanding. I hope you liked the re-air of the episode, which was about the Republican Party, which aired a couple days before the Capitol riots. So I remember when I initially uploaded that, I was like, and then I saw what happened on that Wednesday on January 6th, and I was like, that's interesting timing because it aired the next day.
Right.
So I
remember you saying something about it.
It was an interesting experiment. So yeah. I hope that it brings some clarity about the history of the Republican Party in a time where it seems like political division is at its highest.
Yeah.
We hope we all remember that we are more alike than we are different, and that actions that took place in the Capitol are not have no place in a free and fair society. So I just thought we would get caught up real quick. How have you been?
I'm a dad now.
You are a dad now. It's amazing. I got to meet her the other day, and she's wonderful.
For those who are just listening to the Republic and don't listen to our weekly podcast show, Say What You Mean, my wife and I adopted an 11-year-old girl, and I've been a dad for about a week, just over a week, and it's been awesome. It's been hard. But the more and more time we build trust and spend time together, it just seems to get smoother and smoother. And I think she's really kind of just settling in now. And she's at school right now, which is awesome. we're lucky to have her be able to do school in person. We're doing school at home and in person part time. So, but yeah, it's been great. And your Uncle Jake, and she thinks you have pretty eyes.
Oh, well, thank you. One of my favorite books are the Harry Potter books, and they've always been something that I've turned to. And I've talked openly about my own struggles with mental health on our show, Say What You Mean. Both of us have dealt with it throughout our lives. And I know for me, the books have always been something I've turned to in a time where I just, you know, maybe not escape, but, you know, read something, you know, being able to kind of lose yourself in the pages of a good story.
Right.
And Harry Potter has always been kind of that for me, and so I kind of wanted to pass that on a little bit to your daughter.
Yeah.
And I bought her the first two books, and if she likes them, I will get her the rest of the series. But I'm sure she'll like them, and if not, oh well. But
just a note about that. So you wrote the most incredible like little note to her in it, and you put the quote from the book, and you just said, you know, help will always be there for those who ask for it. And you put some other things in there, but it was just a perfect note. And I shared it, and my mom, like, I called my mom, and she was like, yo, there's no way I'm going to be able to beat that. she got her a book as well. And she said that she was going to write a note in it. And she started with the date, and it wasn't February at the time, but she wrote February and she was like, I've already failed.
Well, I'm sorry.
You set the bar.
Well, I'm sorry to have ruined that for her grandma.
Oh gosh, it's okay.
Anyway, so and I've just have been out exploring the Pacific Northwest. I've really dived deep over the last year into my photography, and I've really been using that as something to help with mental health, but then also just get out and explore and see this wonderful. It's amazing. I lived pretty much my first 30 years in this state, never truly seeing the many wonders that are around.
Absolutely.
So I'm glad I'm taking this. I turned 30 back in November, and now I've been seeing this region, and it makes me. It's so funny because it makes me really appreciate so much more the level and depth of history that like Dr. Sinclair, yeah. That Donna has for this area and the amount of information she taught us in just the Pacific Northwest history class and then just talking to her. And Donna's been on episodes of both our podcasts, and she's been on an episode of To the Republic that we did on environmental policy. And we'll touch on some of that stuff again today as we get into our topic. But gosh, it's just, it's fun walking through it. It's fun driving through the gorge and seeing the dams and realizing just what, you know, the level of what it took to get those dams built, but then also what were the ecological and cultural ramifications to the native populations that those dams had, and being able to fully appreciate everything that is around us, both that was good and bad, had positive, negative consequences. And it adds so much more to the experience.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I just love history.
I've been trying to get out more as well, as you know, and I took public history with Dr. Sinclair. And when you are forced to create those panels that are informative, you definitely make sure that you also stop and appreciate the work that others have done. And so you read those panels.
Yeah.
That's just funny.
I know when, like, Fort Vancouver is like that for me.
Yes.
Because I wrote my senior thesis on stuff about the fort and specifically the Hawaiian fur trade. So anytime I always stop and read that plaque near the Kanaka village near the fort.
Yeah.
Because that's something that is really close to me. So it's funny how public history plays such an important role in our lives, but it just seems like it's so marginal because we walk by it every single day.
Every day.
But always encourage you to stop and read it, because there's people who put a lot of work into that.
Yeah.
And it's work, and it's information that really enhances
the experience. Everything,
the experience around you. It really, truly does. So that's our PSA for
history.
for history. We're both history nerds. As you, if you've listened to us for any amount of time, Jeff and I, and Matt, who's also helps me with this show, we're all history majors at our core, even though we've taken different educational paths. History has always been at our foundation. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate you guys sticking with us. So I think we're just going to do what we do best with this episode, which is we're going to be examining five presidents and their response to crises during their presidencies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I picked George Washington. And so there's kind of two crises that I was looking at. There's an actual crisis of the Whiskey Rebellion that he had to address in his presidency. But then there's the larger issue that we'll get to.
Yeah.
But for those who don't know, the Whiskey Rebellion was in 1794, and it was a reaction to the federal government taxing all distilled alcohols. And because whiskey was popular at the time, it kind of gained that name, the Whiskey Rebellion. So more specifically in Pennsylvania, that's where you kind of saw militias gathering. And if we note the date, 1794, the United States is in its infancy. And this country had just fought a war for independence as a reaction to taxation by England.
And yeah, that's sticky, right?
Like, you're poking the bear.
Yeah.
So the federal government is like, okay, well, we're going to tax whiskey. And there was these militias in Pennsylvania that really started to rise up and gather and started getting a little violent and destructive. And there was even some speaking of secession and starting their own new country already at this point. I know that Washington had sent some delegates to Pennsylvania to kind of negotiate. They had to send those delegates like undercover, like in disguise, to get them there. And they just got booted out immediately. Some delegates' houses were burnt out. It just was not good. In response to this Whiskey Rebellion, Washington. So on September 25th, 1794, President George Washington proclaimed that he was sending a state militia forces to subdue what was dubbed as the Whiskey Rebellion. So he called on the rest of the states to kind of send militia forces, and they met the Whiskey Rebellion and kind of stamped him out, put him out.
Interesting.
And, I mean, for the next following years, you see the federal government kind of trying to enforce this whiskey tax. It's not really working. And then, as you see with following presidents, like, it just kind of, they end the tax. So, the reason I picked this as a kind of, let's look at how Washington or this president handles this crisis is because of two reasons. So, calling a militia at the time was viewed as controversial and almost arguably unconstitutional because that power rested with the Senate. So people were kind of just like, hey, we're in this new government and if we're supposed to abide by the Constitution, the president, the head of state, is already kind of ignoring it and doing what he needs to do to solve this. So whether or not, I mean, that's arguable, right? That is kind of the crisis. Is the Whiskey Rebellion is the crisis, but the overall thing that I was alluding to was the United States is in infancy, and this is the first president, and I think that is the crisis that I wanted to kind of, that I started really looking at.
I love that you went that route, because it shows, you know, that a lot of what is written in the Constitution still has to be hammered out in practice.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And there's still so many things that you just don't know that the founders of the Constitution could never have known were going to be realities. And then how do you go about implementing stuff like that? And I think I love that you're touching on this, because I feel like with my choices for this topic, a lot of that is the same, is that a lot of times there's emergencies that the Constitution or the predominant ideology that everybody was operating on up to this point didn't have an answer for.
Right.
And then it's either does that particular president able to reshift to address it effectively, or do they stand their ground and make the situation worse?
Right.
So anyway, sorry, continue.
No, absolutely. So there was arguments made that like the stamping out of this rebellion with force was worth it because it was saving the new government. But so what we're talking about here is the presidency as a job, as a new role in this new government, in this new nation. So how does that look? How does he navigate through that? How does he respond to, and how mind-blowing is it? Like, I've already said it, but they're taxing. The issue here is tax, and we've just fought a war for independence due to taxation.
Of like consumption, drinks,
right?
Like, that's crazy.
So we're already continuing kind of this, but now we are new, and it's how do we navigate through that? So whether or not it was handled right, I mean, I think, you know, 200 something years later, looks like we're doing okay for now.
Yeah.
So, but I think that Washington is such an interesting, he's in such an interesting position, and everyone in that government at that time is in such an interesting position to continue the beginning of a new nation and to continue the foundation, but also, like you noted, navigate through what rules are established and what they're going to hold back on and push back on and how that looks. So I think in the role of crises specific to presidents, I think his role is just so, I don't know, it's important, obviously, but and not that anybody else isn't, but how I just feel like there would be so much, I get anxious thinking about the pressures that that whole government had. Like, you just got out of a war, and now it's insane to me.
Well, everybody, right, the rhetoric and the narratives that drove the revolution was, you know, freedom and self-governance and independence, liberty.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, and then you're trying to, now there's a government that's newly been formed off of those principles. And then, so you're not only do you have the weight of trying to push down a rebellion that's threatening the future of the Republic, but you've also understanding of what is my role in Washington always had a lot of foresight and understanding that his actions were going to set precedent going forward, and trying to navigate those waters of not overreaching, because understanding that, okay, we're probably going to be able to crush this, but what does it mean for the future of the generation, for future generations of presidents?
Well, and that militia, for them to just, you know, this government just started. It's like, no, I'm not paying this tax.
And I think that you see the limitations of the federal government early, because there isn't a standing army that you can just call on.
Right.
Think of it today, right? When there was a rebellion at the Capitol just a month ago, you had National Guard that were sent there, you know, not quite immediately. It's a different topic, but there's law enforcement, right? There's people to respond to this kind of stuff pretty quickly. Whereas Where does George Washington even call upon?
That's a great point.
Like, where does he, like, what at that point, like, what mechanisms were even available to him to call on?
Not even that, but also the fact that he had to, it had to be a conscious effort to then call on those people.
Yeah.
In what way did he do that? Mm-hmm. You know, he had to call them from different states, but that's a, you know, it's not a snap of a finger, boom, the standing military comes and backs you up. Mm-hmm. It's a process of now having to call these people in.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to note that I said that in the following years, it was repealed. It was TJ who repealed it, Thomas Jefferson.
Okay, yeah. Interesting enough. And that's in line with Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
Because
he's
very much the limited government ideologue.
Yeah.
So versus the Federalist of George Washington.
Right.
Anyway, so interesting. So I think that's perfect introduction into this topic. We've got four more presidents that we're going to examine in the specific crises of their presidencies. So we'll get to those on the other side of the break. But for now, we do need to take a break and listen to our sponsors. You've been listening to The Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
We'll be right back.
Big thank you to Kraft Cannabis, formerly known as New Vansterdam, for their ongoing support of KXRW Vancouver Radio. Kraft Cannabis is Vancouver's premier cannabis market for those 21 years of age and over. Visit craftcannabis.com to view an order from their full online menu, and they offer in-store, curbside, and touchless pickup to better serve you. Kraft Cannabis is located in the Heights Shopping Center on the corner of Mill Plain and Andreessen Road. Open 8 a.m. to 11 p.m., 365 days a year. More information available at craftcannabis.com.
Big thank you to our friends at Boomerang Therapy Works and home of the KXRW Studios. Boomerang is the only physical therapy facility in Vancouver and Portland that specializes in the treatment of neuromuscular disorders and brain injuries like Parkinson's, MS, and stroke. They opened Boomerang to bring premier treatment to their patients. Find Boomerang Therapy Works in action on Instagram or Facebook and see how their patients are inspired in their recovery. They can be reached at 360-258-1637. That's 360-258-1637.
Welcome back to The Republic. I am Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
In our last segment, we prefaced the topic and got into the topic, which is examining some of America's past presidencies, how they handled the crisis, and while also balancing the Constitution and what role did the executive have within the confines of the system. And we talked, Jeff, you talked about George Washington and the Whiskey Rebellion and the hardships that came not with only a rebellion against a tax that was instituted by the National Congress early in America's history, but also how the first president in the first Congress and all of this and how they were able to navigate these really, really tricky waters with calling up a militia and continuing attacks that was unpopular, all that kind of thing. So now we're going to continue with that. And one of the choices that I made for this kind of project was President James Buchanan, who was the 15th president of the United States. And he only served for one term and he didn't run for re-election in 1860. And he was president from 1857 to 1861. So he oversaw the years leading up to the Civil War, which you can probably guess is the crises that I'm talking about. But specifically, it is his role in not doing anything to stop the country from imploding.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, the Civil War was inevitable. We talk about the road to the Civil War, causes and consequences. Matt and I did an episode on mm-hmm. this. And it's really interesting about James Buchanan because as a person, he was a man who tried to avoid conflict as much as possible, which is ironic because ultimately the man who tried to avoid conflict oversaw the beginning of the Civil War.
Right.
No more so was his wanting to avoid conflict apparent than the attack on Fort Sumter in South Carolina, which was a federal fort in kind of the beginning of the Civil War when South Carolina militia attacked a federal fort. And Buchanan, who didn't want to make the situation worse, but had to show some force, sent an unarmed merchant ship for relief of federal forces at Fort Sumter, and then ultimately surrendered the fort to Southern forces. James Buchanan was a Democrat from the North, which put him in a precarious situation because he was pro-slavery, but he was in a state that was very much staunchly anti-slavery.
Right.
So So to backtrack a little bit, we talked about Fort Sumter. I kind of jumped the gun a little bit. But really what James Buchanan's, I don't know if ineptitude is the right word, but mm-hmm. his refusal to take action. And I don't know if this, I mean, if you wanted to be fair, maybe it's his belief in ideology that of a limited federal government. That's, and it's not his yeah. role to, it's not the executive's role to play in this battle over slavery. It should mm-hmm. be left up to the states.
Yeah.
In a way that just looking, I mean, we can look back now and be like, that worked terribly,
yeah,
right?
That
led it to catastrophic failures. But I mean, I guess at the time we still hear these things today, right? Over the budgetary. Mm-hmm. Right now we're going through a pandemic, and you hear senators on the Hill from one party or the other saying, well, you know, the relief package is too expensive, and they're falling back on ideology of limited government, mm-hmm. and it should be up to the states to do this. We're still dealing with this states
Absolutely.
Versus federal ideological battle within our government. So I mean, I guess to really vilify Buchanan is not particularly fair, but this guy takes that to the next step. 2 days after taking office in 1857, the Dred Scott case comes down. Mm-hmm. And what the Dred Scott case did is that the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government cannot ban slavery in the new territories, mm-hmm. amongst other things. It's one of the most explicitly racist federal documents ever created. I mean,
right.
I encourage people to go and read the ruling from Supreme Court Justice Tenney about his ruling on the Dred Scott case. Buchanan, being a pro-slave ideological person, thinks that the Dred Scott case is going to do his job for him
right.
in solving this issue of slavery for the time being while he's in office, mm-hmm. kicking the can further down the road. Ultimately, all the Dred Scott case did was anger the North and further divide Southern Democrats from Northern Democrats mm-hmm. and bring up Bleeding Kansas, which Buchanan's predecessor, President Pierce, signed into act, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which we get into popular sovereignty a bunch in our Causes of the Civil War episode. Mm-hmm. But essentially what it is that it replaced the Missouri Compromise, the Compromise of 1820, with popular sovereignty, which would allow the new territories, now backed by the Dred Scott decision, to be able to decide whether they want to be
a
slave state or a free state.
Yeah.
Both factions within Kansas form their own governments and write their own constitutions. Now, Kansas had far more free soilers than they did slaveholders, than people who were pro-slavery within its borders. But Buchanan backed the Lecompton government of Kansas, which is a pro-slave mm-hmm. government with a pro-slave constitution.
Right.
That angered the North. That angered the Republicans in the Senate even more because what's the point of having popular sovereignty if you're not listening to the people who are in the borders, right? So there was a massively fraudulent election. Congress refuses to uphold the... Congress ends up refusing to accept Kansas's bid for statehood, puts that on hold until 1861. But at that point, the Civil War is already in full swing, and it's a little bit too late. But Kansas, for note, does enter in 1861 as a free state. So, and then Buchanan does not end up running for re-election, but he's still a lame duck president when Abraham Lincoln wins office in November of 1860. Buchanan is still president. As Southern states begin to secede, which he then does nothing about. And you found a quote, which I think sums up Buchanan perfectly.
In his State of the Union message to Congress, Buchanan said he believed that the South's secession wasn't legal, but that the federal government didn't have the power to stop it.
Which is just interesting, right? Like, I don't know how you come to that. That's just basically saying, I don't want to deal with this.
Well, and in contrast to, like, Washington's response that we talked about in the first segment, the argument of, like, we need to put this down if it's going to cost us losing the government we've established. Mm-hmm. So that's why there was force used against a rebellion. Mm-hmm. In this case, a rebellion and secession is happening. And he's just like, what can I do about it?
Yeah. he basically sat on his hands.
Yeah.
And him not, I think he realized what was happening, and that's why he didn't run for re-election.
Right.
Not that he probably would have won, but it's interesting to note that Abraham Lincoln won in 1860, the election of 1860, without receiving a single vote in 9 U.S. states. But he won with 40% of the overall popular vote and then got the majority of the Electoral College mm-hmm. because he won states like New York, Pennsylvania. It's Buchanan's inability, I think, to tackle, to be able to confront a unique crisis in an effective way,
mm-hmm.
and to reframe the role of the presidency to in an era that I think would call for it.
Right.
So that's why I think James Buchanan, in a lot of ways, I think not unfairly, is considered one of the worst presidents in, right. in our history. Not because I think he was necessarily a bad guy. The guy spent his entire career in politics. He was a representative. He was a senator. He spent time in the diplomatic corps. He was the U.S. ambassador to Russia. He was the last president. He's the last president to ever serve as Secretary of State before becoming president.
Mm.
This guy was an accomplished politician,
right.
but just when it came to being that executive,
yeah.
he failed in his in yeah. his role, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think with our next president to analyze, we're going to skip forward a bit in history. There's a lot that we're skipping over, and there's plenty
yeah.
of presidents who had mishandled crises. But we're going to specifically look at Herbert Hoover for this episode, because I think it transitions well into your next president. But for now, we're going to do Hoover in his response to the beginnings of the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm. Is that your crisis? Great Depression?
Yes.
Okay.
The beginnings of the Great Depression, right?
Perfect.
Because the Dust Bowl and the effects of the Great Depression, this lasts for almost two decades,
yeah.
right? And it takes multiple presidents to correct for.
Right.
But Hoover oversaw the precipitous drop in the stock market, and then his lack of response made the situation far worse than it could have been.
Right.
Like he can't stop the ecological disaster and drought from happening in the Midwest, but his farm practices and his policies towards farmers and crediting those farmers, allowing them to go into debt to boost American crop exports, made the ecological disaster in the Midwest that created the Dust Bowl far worse.
Right.
We'll get to all of this. We'll start with Herbert Hoover's presidency. Herbert Hoover was elected in 1928, and he ran as a Republican nominee. He was promising to bring continued peace and prosperity to the nation. I mean, this is towards the end of the Roaring Twenties. Herbert Hoover was seen as like the clear choice for the presidency, and actually, in actuality, he won the electoral vote margin by 444-87.
Oh my word!
A massive landslide.
Yeah,
because he was seen as an incredibly smart economist. He ran the Department of the Treasury for William J. Harding. He was in the Calvin Coolidge administration. Is basically when Calvin Coolidge didn't run for re-election in 1928, he basically handpicked Herbert Hoover as the Republican. As the successor for him on the Republican ticket. And Calvin Coolidge was a popular president because in 1920, but there was a booming economy that was mostly built on sand, but which eventually the chickens come home to roost on this one. And Herbert Hoover's economic ideology was not fit to handle this crisis. He was very much a staunch, this idea of American rugged individualism and limited government and long-run economic theory, which we have an entire episode on capitalism and socialism in different forms of political economy. But Herbert Hoover's core ideology and how the economy worked was that eventually, if you leave the economy alone, things will correct for mm-hmm. itself. Unfortunately, you're talking about the suffering of millions and millions of people until the economy corrects itself.
Right.
So what is the role of the federal government to stop the suffering of its people? I think that's a fair question to
Absolutely.
Ask.
Absolutely.
Herbert Hoover, I think, fails in his response to that question.
Right.
Most notably because, as you see, we can look back and see how Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to tackle the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl
mm-hmm.
with his massive federal package and massive federal intervention in the economy and the environment, is this in complete stark contrast
oh,
to
yeah.
Herbert Hoover. We can go down the litany of bad decisions that Hoover made, but ultimately I think that, I mean, we can focus on a few of them. I think one for me is the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. As mm-hmm. prices began to drop and global trades became to a standstill, people were not buying American goods because American is an industrial nation at this point. We needed to be exporting goods instead of trying to drop tariffs. And then sticking with the gold standard, where if they had gotten off the gold standard like England did, we could have devalued our currency, which would allow more money to flow in. We end up with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, which were the exact opposite of what we should have been doing at the time, as economists note, especially Keynes, who was alive at the time. Herbert Hoover not calling in experts.
Right.
where have we seen this before? Hoover gooes along and passes the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, which put a really, really high tariff on imports, which then result in other countries passing equal tariffs on the United States, which basically brings global trade to a standstill at the time when you need the flow of capital, which exacerbates the situation. And I think that's just more or less just how Herbert Hoover saw himself. I think he was a guy that generally tried to do good, mm-hmm. but his understanding of economics at the time,
yeah.
and his inability to reframe his thinking to challenge a new crisis, because up to this point, the federal government really, outside of its response to the Civil War under Lincoln, the federal government is still fairly like weak compared to states at this point.
Right.
It's not until FDR that you really see the federal government take over in terms of its predominance over the states. And we'll touch on this as we start talking about FDR. However, Hoover's inability to rise to the occasion and think outside the box. And he, even to his credit, he said he didn't want to do anything that he saw as unconstitutional to address the Great Depression.
Right.
So I think in his mind, he's trying to do the right thing as mm-hmm. his role as a president, but it ultimately backfired.
Oh, yeah.
So that's Herbert Hoover's response to the Great Depression and why I think that he failed and is thought of a lot as another one of America's worst presidents.
Right.
So now I think we're going to take a break before we get into FDR's response to Herbert Hoover's failing. I keep tripping over his name.
That's a rough one.
It's a tongue twister, especially when you're talking really fast. Anyway, so when we get on the other side of the break, we'll continue to discuss two more presidents. And so for now, we're going to take a break. Listen to our sponsors. I am Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
You've been listening to The Republic. We'll be right back.
Community radio like this is brought to you by the generous support by our founding sponsors at Adco Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. Adco features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at adco1.com. That's ADCO, the number 1.com.
Many thanks to our sponsor and friends at Say Chow Columbia River Tap Room and Eatery. Chef Peter has been cooking for over 27 years in the Vancouver area. Say Chow, Greater Vancouver's premier catering company. Conveniently located at 2501 Southeast Columbia Way in Vancouver. Dine in or take out for lunch, Monday through Friday, 11 to 2 p.m. Hours will change and live local music will return once again as COVID phases allow. More information available at say-chow.com. That's say-chiao.com or directly at 360-210-5522.
Welcome back to the Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
In our last segment, we talked about two presidents, Herbert Hoover and James Buchanan, who were both presidents at before two of the biggest crises that we learn in our history books, which were the Civil War and the Great Depression. These were the presidents that oversaw the country before those things really take place. And I think it's their inability to use the tools of the federal government to address the challenges at the time instead sitting back and allowing others to try to address those problems. And we talked about this in the first segment that, you know, it's an ongoing debate about the role of the federal government. And there's definitely an ideological divide within the two parties about what the role of the federal government should be. But I think something that is starting to show as we're looking at different presidencies is that in time of crises, the federal government's ability to coordinate cannot be replicated by any other entity
right.
in the United States, at least in my opinion. And I think that is really well shown in FDR's presidency, mm-hmm. which I think you had some great notes on and we're going to talk about.
Yeah. So what I love about what you were discussing in Hoover in the last segment is like you just kind of see this downward spiral and everything just seems to be getting worse for the American people as far as the Great Depression and as far as what I want to discuss. You know, I could discuss so much about FDR as far as crises, mm-hmm. but I think that also... I mean, he was president from 1933 to 1945. So
yes, He was elected four times.
Yeah, that range, you're going to run into some crises. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to just stick to one specific one, and the reason why is because of the way that he addressed it, and that was the Dust Bowl.
Sure.
So as you noted, the economy's spiraling, and things are getting worse under Hoover, and then FDR is elected. And what I appreciate, just as far as the economy, I want to address is Roosevelt came in and had this 100 days plan, and the first thing he did was just close all the banks for several days while Congress could pass reform legislation. And what I appreciate about this is just like everyone just stop for a second. Let's take a minute and let's address this.
Okay.
And that's kind of how he came in, right? And so following that, he just had he instituted programs like I mean, we have Roosevelt's New Deal, right? Which included the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, the Public Works Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and the Tennessee Valley Authority. So, I mean, there are just all these programs, and these are programs that are responses to the Dust Bowl, which now I'll get to. So the Dust Bowl was caused by several economic agricultural factors, including the federal land policies, changes in regional weather, farm economics, and other factors. After the Civil War, a series of federal land acts coaxed pioneers westward by incentivizing farming in the Great Plains. So there's this encouragement to go west and start farming and start farming wheat in lands that weren't really made to do so. And they, you know, farmers went west, started homesteading, and started just farming incorrectly and just tearing the soil up, reusing the soil, trying to maximize production.
Because they were told in the government at the time was saying it's a way to get rich quick.
Yeah, up to this point.
Yeah.
They were told that. And so, which created this layer of topsoil that was just unusable. And that just created these massive dust storms. The winds were blowing through the plains. There was no grass, no plants. Everything that had been through there was all tore up so that they could start farms. And now you just have topsoil that's unusable, farmers moving on to areas they can hope, and then there's a 10-year drought.
Yeah, in addition to that, like, Hoover gave price guarantees to wheat, which kept people continuing to farm when they probably shouldn't have.
Right.
And then also the mechanization allowed for that transformation of the Great Plains
even faster.
Which was tractors, which most people moving out of the cities needed financing for. So they went to the banks for loans on these. But then as soon as the banks started failing, they started calling in their loans, which put even more pressure on the banks. You can just see how all of this is cyclical.
On the farmers. To then produce. To then tear up the soil.
Yeah, exactly.
If you haven't learned about the Dust Bowl, just look at some of the pictures and the footage of just soil moving.
Yeah.
Massive amounts of soil. And the gnarliest thing about this is these giant soil dust storms, because of the friction of the dust, are just riddled with electricity as they're just sweeping across the nation. One storm even reached the Atlantic, right? So on top of the economic crisis of the Great Depression, what does FDR need to do? And what I appreciate about FDR is he brings in professionals to then start these programs and to then start addressing the issue of soil, the issue of climate. And what do we need to do to, not climate, but environment. What do we need to do to address this these things? And he brings these and starts brings in these experts, starts these organizations to then teach the farmers, hey, there's literally from north to south, he had trees planted to ground the soil, but then to also kind of blockade winds and storms, and teaching farmers proper ways to resoil and use soil and nutrition's in soil. And I just appreciate the value of experts in response to this crisis. And that's why I wanted to choose this one specifically. We could look economics. We could the beginning of World War II. I just value and appreciate the reliance on experts and scientists to address the issues of, because at the time these farmers didn't know. And like you had mentioned, they had moved from the city westward. They don't know any different on how these farmers and soil works, topsoil being, you know, I can't imagine just the complete awe of a dust storm just covering your covering your home and your family, your children are getting sick, and just no understanding, right? Mm-hmm. But then, as you mentioned earlier, the federal government stepping in and saying, we've got to do something about this. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, he came in and immediately paused, pressed pause for the banks, right? But also, in a sense, did the same thing with the Dust Bowl. He didn't just let it go. He addressed it by creating all of these organizations to then just teach Americans and help Americans mm-hmm. through this Dust Bowl. Another thing that I thought was really interesting that I found, so on June 4th, 1934, became president in 1933, mm-hmm. On June 4th, he asked Congress to appropriate $52.5 million, which would today be, in 2017, was when this article was written, would be $7.7 billion to address the Midwest drought relief. Mm. Now, this funding is not just for the drought, but you had all of these people just moving, continuously moving west. After their homes are covered in dust, there's no farmland to then be cultivated. And so they move west to find work in the middle of the Depression. Mm-hmm. Just you have migrations of people just looking for work, looking for food, looking for ways to survive. And they're all referred to as Okies, even though they all weren't from Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. But there was, it's just so interesting as I'm seeing as through this research, you have the droughts, but to address, like, to provide money and means for people who were struggling during mm-hmm. this time.
Yeah.
Which is something that we're seeing today in our crisis of a global pandemic.
Yeah.
Which is kind of why I see the parallels in FDR, not FDR specifically, but of the crisis of the Dust Bowl and the Depression with today we see the pandemic, and there's this battle for funding and providing for people, but also how does the government respond in the sense of, are we using science? Are we using, what are the means of which mm-hmm. we are addressing the spread of this pandemic?
Yeah. And the, which is so interesting, right, is that forever the cultivation and the spread of America across the West,
right,
was needed, and we went about it with the Homestead Act and the Railroad Act mm-hmm. and all these things of trying to set up to get people to move west, whether through faulty science or through and there was faulty science,
yeah.
Like the Department of what ultimately became the Department of Agriculture under the Hoover administration, mm-hmm. legitimately told people that don't worry that Oklahoma and North Texas, that there's no irrigation and it doesn't rain a whole lot, your crops will still grow because the dust that you're tilling up will create clouds, which will
yes.
then cause rain.
Oh yeah.
It's that kind of manipulation of the federal bureaucracies yeah. to then push other, like the movement of people or push
yeah.
certain political goals that, you know, may or may not be needed, but you can see the ramifications of those. And then when it comes time to fix the negative externalities of those,
mm-hmm.
the people in charge of the federal government not either willing or able to address them.
Another thing that I had found was that, you know, livestock is not surviving in this environment.
Mm-mm.
And so the federal government started purchasing livestock or paying farmers to euthanize their livestock.
Yeah.
But if the livestock, because you couldn't eat them, they were starving. Mm-hmm. But if there was livestock that you could eat, the federal government was offering farmers money for that to then feed the homeless or those struggling through this economic
wow.
time. So you're just seeing this complete interjection of the federal government mm-hmm. to manage through these crises.
Yeah. And it gets back to this debate is, you know, what kind of, once you've given the federal government that much,
right,
that much power to unilaterally do all of these things, what kind of government are you looking for? Do you start to sacrifice liberty for security? So, I mean, that's a debate that we're still having. And I think that liberty versus security is something that we will see a lot when we talk about George W. Bush's presidency and his response to the September 11th terror mm-hmm. attacks and how over-government intrusion can be the wrong response to a crisis in relation to the security versus liberty debate.
But I do appreciate his response to the Dust Bowl and, you know, one simple idea and one simple thought is that when we're discussing this federal oversight or federal reach, the state autonomy and the ability to govern within our states is great, but I'm looking at the federal government as uniting, mm-hmm. right? The United States, that oversight to get everybody together and address the issues. Mm-hmm. Like I said, in those first 100 days, he had Congress get together to pass reform legislation to address the issues of the banks.
Yeah.
That was initiated by him, the federal government getting the states together. We got to figure this mm-hmm. out. So,
and that's correcting from the decentralization of the banks during the Andrew Jackson administration,
right.
way back in the 1820s.
Right.
A full century before, a legacy of that is what led to the banking crisis that ultimately worsened the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. And FDR now creating more of a centralized bank that can then bail out banks when these crises
right.
hit. It was something that FDR called upon John Maynard Keynes to kind of help formulate that policy. So calling in
experts.
Important.
Yes.
So now we'll move on to George W. Bush
mm-hmm.
in his response to the 9/11 terror attacks. And I specifically wanted, because this is something you and I have talked about on the podcast, and that is I don't want to talk about the use of U.S. troops abroad or anything like that. That's
right.
all very important. But I specifically wanted to talk about George W. Bush's passing of the Patriot Act
mm-hmm.
and NSA and the ability of the federal government to basically violate our civil liberties in the name of security.
Right.
And so this is obviously a president that it's much more fresh in most of our minds. We lived through this.
I almost chose him.
Did you?
And for this exact reason.
Okay. So
I'm glad you did.
So I'm glad you and I are going to be able to, I think, have a good discussion on
right.
this, because I think we fall kind of on the same side, but we probably have a little bit of a few differences.
We'll see.
But I think George W. Bush was in a very inenviable spot
mm-hmm.
with him taking office. And George W. Bush did not come in to the presidency on a hawkish message.
Right.
It wasn't that he was looking to go and start foreign wars.
Mm-hmm.
But his response to the crisis that fell on his lap was, I think, looking in hindsight, one, expanded the role of the federal government to a point where I think us as general Americans are not comfortable with the federal government having that level of capability
right.
to violate our privacy. But then also his use of not just fighting a war in Afghanistan, but creating this global fight against terrorism that expanded the president's wartime powers.
Yeah.
Removing Congress from that checks and removing Congress's checks and balances
yes.
in the declaration of war powers.
Right.
And I think that's something that is very concerning. So just as a brief history, in 2001, Al-Qaeda backed attacked the United States in New York and Washington, D.C., killing thousands of Americans. George W. Bush, who had just become president at the time, begins a whole slew of executive orders, but with the backing of Congress, to go and find those responsible for this. That ultimately, he had a lot of support, even through 2003 with the invasion of Iraq, which is questionable. But specifically, I want to talk about the passing of the Patriot Act,
mm-hmm.
which is actually an acronym, if you didn't know.
I did not know that.
The USA Patriot is an acronym.
Mm-hmm.
So it stands for the Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act of 2001.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I guess that is a very interesting title.
I will say it's a little more illuminating than I, you know, because when I hear Patriot Act, I'm like, okay, what are you? You're applying patriotism to this act,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, they kind of still are,
yeah.
but the acronym is
mm-hmm.
different.
What's okay. interesting is that, so the party, the Republican Party, traditionally has been the party, at least in the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
was a party who did not, as we've looked with Hoover, mm-hmm. right, in relation to FDR, who was a Democrat, and you look at Reagan and you look at George H.W. Bush, a lot of Republicans are generally less likely to use federal tools to combat crises.
Right.
enter George W. Bush in the 21st century with now the threat of terrorism,
mm-hmm.
and how that, and you see a lot of his national addresses trying to reframe what freedom means.
Mm-hmm.
One, as a political tool to expand his his idea of U.S. foreign policy abroad, which is to create freedom through democratic institutions, overthrowing of dictators,
right.
and installing democratic governments, frame patriotism and freedom to this expanded definition,
yes.
that would allow for far more government control.
Mm-hmm.
It culminates in the passing of this U.S. Patriot Act, which allows for far more, I think, than we even understood at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Intrusion into our civil liberties.
Yeah.
And I think that, in my opinion, that was the wrong response. As things have come out from, you and I have talked a lot about Edward Snowden. I don't agree. I don't like Edward Snowden. I don't agree with what he did.
Right.
But it did illuminate a lot of what the federal government had been doing.
Right.
That we kind of want, I mean, in my opinion, I don't want it to continue.
Right.
So what are some of your thoughts?
Some of my thoughts are the power of fear at mm-hmm. the time. And maybe even this, heightened fear
mm-hmm.
or intentionally heightened fear. And that's a whole nother debate on who is controlling that, right? But the point is that the United States was attacked
yeah.
and there were 3,000 people who died because of it. So it's just concerning. It's not concerning. What I want to say is that there is this idea of fear and surviving, right? How are we going to get through this is kind of the thought. And you look at the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. How are we going to get through this? You look through Washington in segment one where we talk about just starting the nation. How are we going to get through this? There is this weird balance and this weird difficult questioning of mm-hmm. what are we going to allow the government to do and what are we going to do as citizens? And fear is, you know, at what point does anyone push back on FDR's initiatives and ideas and organizations
mm-hmm.
when people are starving, people are dying, people are poor? You know, there's just a lot. And so in that same scope with the Patriot Act, you see, you know, those of us who were there, and hopefully we have listeners who are learning about this through mm-hmm. this show, that it was a shock to the system, a shock to the nation. You know, it was the largest attack since Pearl Harbor on United States soil. So my thought is there is a very difficult process in which the United States citizens have to go through when considering what are we going to allow the federal government to do to set parameters or protect against or for us in these crises?
Mm-hmm.
This is a crisis.
Yeah.
What do we allow the government to do? And because of fear, because of hunger, because of deaths, after doing anything and everything you can on by your own means, it goes back to that federal government kind of uniting everybody. And the Patriot Act is one that is very controversial mm-hmm. and as far as overreach, but at the time you're instituting new abilities of the federal government
yeah.
for what? For protection because of fear? What is the issue here? Why are we allowing this? And I think that historically, when you look at it, I think that that's the reason why is people were scared.
Yeah.
And they wanted to stop terrorism or anything like this ever happening again.
Mm-hmm. I 100% get that. I mean, I've listened to Donald Rumsfeld talk extensively
yes, yes.
about being in charge of the Defense Department when the country got hit. Like, you were the person who's in charge of American defense,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, you're the chief executive person in the DOD, and this happened on your watch.
Yeah.
And he talked about it was a failure of imagination. We didn't think that they could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then now you, like you said it perfectly, it's a shock to the system, mm-hmm. right? It makes you have to reframe how you think about things,
yes.
right? And I think the at the moment, emotions were raw. We don't want this to happen again. What do we need to do to make sure that it doesn't? Whether it was the right or wrong decision, I think that what before something like that was passed, one thing like is in relation to FDR. FDR saw the problem and figured out a solution based on the actual environmental realities.
Right.
Whereas the NSA and what they're to the level that they were able to spy on citizens, essentially, what did that, was that overextensive to the environmental realities? Like, what was the United States really at threat from terrorism? Mm-hmm. Like, our government was not going to be overthrown by non-state actors.
Right.
So, but the response was almost like a wartime response from a conventional near-peer actor.
That's a great point,
being
Jake.
Being overthrowing our borders.
Yes, that's
so
a great point.
So I feel
point.
Like the response of the Bush administration far exceeded the actual realities
yes.
of the threat.
That's an excellent
and
point.
That's why I think we hold up FDR's response to the Dust Bowl as being appropriate
mm-hmm.
and okay, even as a more of a conservative person like me saying yeah. I agree with the federal overreach because it matched, right?
It
the
was
environmental
adequate.
Reality.
Yes.
It adequately matched. You can see
that's so well
that,
said,
that,
ex- Jake.
That experience, that overreach met the environmental realities of the time.
The
whereas
needs.
This, that I feel like the response was over than what was needed. And that's why I critique the Bush administration for passing the Patriot Act.
That was amazing.
So
that's why we do this.
So I just wanted to thank you guys all for listening. This is always so much fun to do with you, Jeff.
Yeah, I need to do it more.
And I hope that you do.
Yeah, I need to.
You're well. This was our show. This
yeah.
is our show, and I appreciate you sitting down with me. All that you have going on in your life right now, this is probably one of the least things that you wanted to do. But
I always say that, but then when I do it, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot how fun this was.
It is a lot of fun, and we like to thank KXRW for giving us the platform to do this and share with you our research and continue to have fun with history. So I hope you guys all enjoyed this episode. If you want to continue listening or listen to our backlog, please go to kxrw.fm, and we'll be back next month. Thank you guys all for listening. This is To the Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
We'll see you next month.
Big thank you to Craft Cannabis, formerly known as New Vansterdam, for their ongoing support of KXRW Vancouver Radio. Craft Cannabis is Vancouver's premier cannabis market for those 21 years of age and over. Visit craftcannabis.com to view an order from their full online menu, and they offer in-store, curbside, and touchless pickup to better serve you. Craft Cannabis is located in the Heights Shopping Center on the corner of Mill Plain and Andreessen Road. Open 8 a.m. to 11 p.m., 365 days a year. More information available at craftcannabis.com. KXRW would like to thank our friends at Ferrar's Bistro for their ongoing support of community radio. Ferrar's Bistro has a family-friendly vibe and comfort food with a flair. Ferrar's Bistro has attracted both Vancouver locals and out-of-towners since their doors first opened in 2007. Dine-in, take-out, or delivery is offered. More information available at ferrarsbistro.com. That's F-A-R-R-A-R-S-Bistro.com.